Welcome to the Buy and Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show poet Dara Fleming. Now, I came across Dara through one of his poems that was posted on Instagram entitled If I Ever Have Boys, and it resonated with me so deeply that I wanted to reach out to him. As I dove into his work, I discovered that a lot of it also addressed mental health, another commonality with this podcast. So we discuss a host of topics, from his own childhood, losing a friend to suicide, catharsis through poetry, his own powerful mental health story, some of his favorite poems, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dara Fleming. Enjoy. Well, Dara, I want to start by saying, firstly, I came across you on social media when you were reading If I Ever Have Boys. And I want to obviously get to that poem as we progress through here. But I was so moved by that I wanted to reach out to you on social media. And I want to thank you so much for saying yes and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, no, it's an absolute pleasure. I feel like at this point, a lot of people found me that way, that poem. Yeah, just really connected with people. And I suppose just at the top, I have a lot of gratitude and I suppose credit due to Lucas Jones, who that poem was in response to Lucas. So without him, none of that would have happened for me either. But it's something I think about a lot, because I don't have children yet. So like how I would raise my children, especially in the world we live in now with all the so many influences, and a lot of them are negative, that it's important to think about.
Absolutely. Well, we'll dive into that. Very first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you this evening?
We're finding me in Dublin, Ireland. I just was saying before we started recording, I've been here all of 2 weeks. So I came from Cork, where I'm originally from. And I just moved back from Barcelona in February. So there's been a lot of chopping and changing this calendar year, but we're settled in Dublin now.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so born originally in Cork in Ballinlough. Just me, my mom and dad and my older brother. My brother is a year older than me. So we grew up together. Basically, we were just very close. There's only 13 months between us. So like we've just always been best friends, which has been great. Like to be able to grow up with your best friend is really special. And then my parents came from working class backgrounds, kind of crawled and clawed their way to the working class. My dad worked as a security officer for a while, and then he was a private investigator, which was a very cool job to say your dad had. And now he's back working security again. And then my mother was still is a regional manager for a wholesaler. So like supplying to shops and stuff. So that was kind of her background. And it was very like just the four of us, really straightforward, simple, nothing of note, which is good. Like there was no extreme negatives. It was just, a really simple, lovely childhood. We were really lucky to have that because I know not everyone does.
Were there any stories from your dad's career when he was a private investigator that he talks about, kind of interesting or funny?
Yeah, so I mean, I remember like there'd be days he'd pick me up from school and he'd be like, I'm still working, so you need to come with me. And it would be a case of like me sitting in the front of a van, his van, and him getting into the back. And there was like a black curtain, and then there'd just be like a camera lens coming out next to my head and he'd be taking pictures. But it was just all, it was a lot of insurance fraud. And he'd have to do like, I suppose the ones that got funnier, kind of nuts, were the when he had to, you know, serve people their court summons, and people would just run away in them or drive away from him, and he'd be chasing them through the streets. And that just sounds like a big Hollywood movie, but like that was the reality. But that didn't happen very often. Like most of his job was like waiting around for people and just basically like, say if they were claiming that they'd like hurt their neck and they couldn't work, and then he'd like catch them doing like backflips in their back garden or something, and then it'll be like, oh well, you're lying about your neck injury. That was kind of the job, which is basically, he was a professional rat, god love him. Like
so where you grew up, was that in an urban setting or was it more rural?
So where I was born was kind of suburbs, the suburbs of Cork. And then when I was four, my parents bought their first house, and we moved out to kind of outside the suburbs. So it was in, yeah, very much rural, but it was still only like 15 minutes from the city. So I lived next to like, there was probably three houses next to us. Then across the road from us, there was like a pig farm, and next to us, they grew maize, and they also used to have cows in there. So we very much grew up in the countryside, which at the time as a four-year-old, I was absolutely raging about, because I thought they were ruining my life moving us out of the city. But it was actually like turned out to be the best thing that could have happened. It was really nice. And we had the best of both worlds, because as I said, we were only like a 15-minute drive from the city if we did want to go in. And we went to school in the city as well. So we kind of lived in between the city and kind of rural Ireland, which is nice.
I grew up on a farm myself outside Bath, and I was actually just talking to my wife about this yesterday. There was a lot of time where I was just on my own, you know. I mean, I had siblings as well, but you know, you're on out in the fields and you're climbing trees or you're mucking out stables or whatever it is, compared to the distractions and the kind of information barrage that a lot of our young people are exposed to now. When you reflect back, did that environment kind of feed the fire when it came to the introspection that you're known for now?
That's a really good question. I would say like it has to have, whether I was aware of it or not, because yeah, inherently, like, you know, you're even that stuff that I take for granted now back in cities, like you go to, when you're going to sleep at night, it's quiet and you have time to think. Whereas like if you're in the kind of city environment, there's always something going on and there's always something to be distracted by. So I think like living in a place where everything's a lot slower and people give time to doing nothing. And I think that's really important for that introspective piece or for art, like allowing yourself time to do nothing is massively important. And I think because of technology, because of our phones, we avoid doing nothing all the time. We're like terrified to be bored. But I find that that's where all the ideas come from, because your brain tries to like entertain itself in that sense. But to get back to your question, I think, yeah, I like, it's hard to say because I don't have the comparison. Like it would be great if there was two versions of me that grew up, one in the city, one in the rural Ireland, to see how they both panned out. But I would say if I had to hazard a guess, it has had a massive impact. Yeah.
So what about kind of sports activities? What were you doing during those school ages back then?
I was very uninterested in sport. I tried a lot of them until I found basketball. And once I found basketball, my whole life changed. Like it was like I finally understood why everyone else liked sport. Like this was my sport. And I had like I was terrible at the start, but I definitely had a natural curiosity and like a desire to get better at it. And I just became massively obsessed with basketball to the point that I started playing at 11, I only stopped playing during the pandemic. So that would have been like 17 years of my life. And I got to the level of playing like Super League, which is the highest level you can play in Ireland. So that just consumed my entire teenage life. Up until I found basketball, it was like head in the books, reading all the time. I was writing a lot as a child. Found basketball, threw all that stuff out the window, and I was like, this is now the most important thing in my life. But beyond that, yeah, I was terrible at football. Then there's the GAA in Ireland, which are kind of our own, you know, in-house sports, really bad at those. But I just seemed to be good at basketball, so I stuck with that and pretended no other sport existed.
What about writing? I've heard you talking about, you know, very, very young writing your first poem. I think it was in your TED talk.
Yeah, so I suppose what precedes the writing is the reading. And since I was able to read, which was around 3 or 4, I always had a book. Like, I was always reading. I was reading before bed. I was reading when I woke up in the morning. Anytime I kind of had moments to read, I read. And granted, like, in the 90s, this was a lot easier because you didn't have your streaming services and your Netflix. So there was kind of nothing else to do unless there was something I wanted to watch on at the right time. So yeah, just reading all the time. And then, yeah, the first poem was about a monkey, because I remember as a kid I was obsessed with monkeys, so I just wanted to write a poem about them. And then I wrote my first short story, which was like very probably like offensive to Irish people because it was about a leprechaun. So I was kind of attacking my own people in a sense. But it was about a leprechaun, whatever, saving the world, etc. And then from there, like, in English, I always wanted to do the creative answer, like write the short story, write the essay. That was what I was most interested in. So writing was always there. And I remember even my mother, say when I was 13, she turned to me, she dropped me to school one morning, and she was like, I don't know what it's going to look like or whatever, but you're going to be doing, she was like, you're going to be working in writing in some capacity when you're older, whether it's journalism, whether it's like writing books. And like, sure, I was 13, I was like, will you go away, like, that's total nonsense, like. But as it happened, she predicted the future.
So what were you dreaming of becoming when you were in the school age?
Well, like, I definitely had aspirations to be a professional basketball player and be in the NBA. I think that everyone who was on my team, you know, had those aspirations, which is a high, tall order for like an Irish kid, because we're not inherently like the most adapted to basketball. But having said that, like, we have produced a lot of great basketball players. There's a few playing in the States. CJ Flood is actually playing in the G League at the moment, and he's from the north of Ireland. So like, yeah, that was the aspiration, though. It was this the equivalent of like, my brother wanted to be playing for Liverpool, I wanted to play for, you know, the New York Knicks or something. But that, yeah, that was just a dream, really, I suppose. Like, and this is something I actually struggled with as a kid, because when you're 18 in Ireland, you kind of have to decide what you're going to do with the rest of your life then and there, because, you know, you have to decide based on your test scores what college degree you're going to do, and then that basically becomes your path. And I didn't have a clue. Like, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I was really jealous of people like my brother, because he knew fairly early he wanted to be an engineer and went on and became an engineer. Whereas I was just kind of like, I could be a physio, or I could do psychology, or I could go into computer science, or I could go into business. Like I just didn't have any clue at all, which is good and bad, I suppose.
Well, you mentioned about obviously losing a best friend when you were 17. So let's kind of go back in time a little bit first. Tell me about your friend, and then let's kind of walk through losing him.
Yeah. So Irby was originally from Chicago, and his family emigrated to Ireland when he was very young, like he would have been 3 or 4. And I didn't meet him till I was 13. And the reason how I met him was I was in first year, he was in second year, he was in school, he was in the same year as my brother, and they were in the, you know, just, we were all in the same school. And every year, two first year basketball players, like the two best players, were asked to play with the second year team as well. So you could like play up a year. So I was one of those players. And at the start, I remember Irby didn't like, kind of the whole team didn't like me, because it was like, oh, what's a first year doing playing with us? Like, whatever. But then they found out I could actually play, and I was actually useful. And that's where me and Irby kind of began our friendship. It was very much centered around basketball. And after that, like, we'd spend most of our time either playing basketball, if the weather allowed it, outside one of our houses, or we'd be inside playing, you know, NBA 2K or something. So that's where, how we met. And we just got really close really quick. And it was just a really, like, just a light and, like, fun friendship. You know, we laughed a lot. We, you know, the things teenage boys talk about, like talking about girls we liked, what we're going to do at the weekend, who was going to get us naggins when we went drinking, all this kind of, you know, stuff you do as a teenager. And we hung out together in a group with my older brother, Killian, and two other lads that were in their year as well. So there was kind of five of us. And then in the wider group, there was, like, you know, half a Cork, it was whatever. We all kind of hung out together in a sense, but it was the five of us, and we were really, like, tight knit. We did everything, like staying in each other's houses and just staying up all night and just being teenage boys. Like, and I suppose, like, to contextualize why, well, I mean, suicide is always traumatic, but we were lucky that, like, there hadn't been much tragedy in our lives. There was a few guys we knew who'd lost their fathers quite early in life, which was really hard. And there was a few people who were, like, we knew in our school classes that were quite sick, but we hadn't really experienced, like, real grief or like devastating heartbreak beyond girlfriends breaking up with us or whatever. When Irby died, it was really painful. One, because he was gone, and two, I felt so guilty because I had no idea he was struggling, and no one did. Like, no one. It was such a surprise that it happened, because none of us even, like, questioned that he was struggling with something. And I suppose that's the terrifying thing about depression, and having gone through it myself, I can attest to it, that, like, you can really act like everything's fine. You can put on the show. You can, you know, Irby was always out with us at the weekends. He was always playing basketball. He was always having fun, laughing, you know, texting girls, all the stuff everyone was doing. But behind all of that, he was having a really hard time. And he ended up taking his own life.
When you look back now, obviously, you know, a lot later, with the mental health conversation having evolved hugely, certainly over the last 10 years or so, were there any elements of his upbringing, of his surroundings, that you think, you know, were contributing to this, even though he was wearing that mask that so many of us put on?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of factors, like, that looking back now, you can kind of see it. So one was, like, Irby wasn't very interested in school. Like, wasn't his thing. And I mean, a lot of kids aren't interested in school, but he would have got a lot of pressure from, like, a parental level about his academic work. And I remember he was even switched school. He was switched out of our school for a couple of years and brought back because he wasn't, like, achieving what was wanted at home. So I think the year he took his own life was the year he was doing his, like, final exams of secondary school. So they're, like, the biggest exams you sit in Ireland as a teenager. It's called a Leaving Cert. So he took his own life in January, and the exams were in May, and the pre-exams, like the mocks, were coming up in February. So all that was, like, in his head, and, like, he hated school, didn't study, didn't like it. So I think that was a major thing. And, you know, I've been talking about it a lot recently, how, like, the Leaving Cert can be dangerous for teenagers, like, because it can cause them to, like, want to kill themselves, which is not really, like, conducive with, like, a good education and well-being that, like, the system is causing teenagers to want to kill themselves. So that was a major factor. And then, like, I think, like, yeah, to be honest, that's, like, I can't know, this is speculation because he didn't leave a note or anything, but I think it was mainly that is what pushed him over the edge.
This is an important part of this whole mental health conversation. A lot of people that come on the show, you know, they're first responders, they're military members. So, you know, there's other areas of trauma that are very acute as well. But I had a high school student on, Emma Benoit, and it was her that was the big thing for her. She had a loving upbringing, but it was the pressure of school. And she was, you know, a beautiful girl and a cheerleader, if I remember rightly. And she survived her suicide attempt. She's in a wheelchair now, but she became a mental health advocate. But it was that pressure of not knowing. And I had another guest on, Angela Lee, who's a martial artist. She had her own attempt and survived. She kind of deliberately crashed her car, and then she lost her younger sister to suicide. And in that household, there was, again, this pressure in the martial arts world for these two girls to be, you know, world champions, as it were. So not saying this was the case with Irby specifically, but the danger of living vicariously through your kids, putting expectations on them that maybe just don't fit their specific road as a parent is something to be mindful of. And certainly then kind of looking for the signs if that kind of expectation is putting undue pressure on.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Like, and the thing with Irby, like, he was an incredible athlete, you know, like, and I think the issue with school is, like, we kind of tell kids there's only one way to be smart. Like, there's only one way to have intelligence. Whereas, like, you know, in school, you're not tested for, like, your integrity or your compassion or your artistic creativity or your, like, ability to play sport. Like, none of them are, like, seen as, like, obviously you can do them in school, but none of them are seen as, like, a basis for your future. Everything's based on the books, and just, like, that doesn't fit. Like, not everyone's going to fit that mold. Like, so, yeah, it's a really important point.
All right, so at 17 years old, you kind of thrust into this, you know, realization of mortality. You've had this tragic loss of a friend. How does that impact your own grief and mental health journey?
So it was really, like, confusing, because, like, there was a big part of me that felt like I'd let Irby down, mainly because, so basically, he took his life on a Wednesday, right? And we used to get a half day on a Wednesday, and he came up to me so it was lunchtime on the Wednesday, and, like, we'd often hang out on that day, but also sometimes we'd go hang out with different friends. And he came up to me and he was like, "Hey, do you want to get lunch?" And I had other plans. Like, I was going into town to meet some friends from my own year, so I was like, "Oh, I have other plans. I can't go for lunch, but I'll see you at training tonight." We had training that evening. And he was like, "Oh yeah, there's no worries." Like, and often, like, you know, we'd either go for lunch, or he'd say he couldn't, or I'd say I couldn't. So it wasn't like a massive big deal. Like, it was just like, can't go for lunch. And then it happened that night was the night he took his own life. And, like, similar to the other stories you were talking about a while ago, he didn't actually end up dying. So they got to him in time, and then he died in the hospital as a result of complications of what he did. So I had that kind of guilt hanging over me. I was grieving, but very quickly I stopped feeling anything. Like, there was no anger, there was no sadness, there was no happiness. And because there was no mental health education, I just thought that's how grief was, that's how it worked, and I just pull out of it. And then it, you know, as the years went on, I got to 18, I still wasn't feeling anything. And then I just thought that's how adults were. Like, I was like, okay, adults just don't feel anything, and they just pretend, and they, like, you know, they act out the emotions they're expected to. And I was like, I was emotionally intelligent enough to know what emotions people expected from me. So, like, if I got a good exam result, I'd know that they want me to be happy, so I'd, like, perform that, or if we won a match, or if we lost a match, whatever. So the fallout was, like, I was depressed for 4 years. It took me, I went on to study applied psychology because I was like, right, I don't want to, like, go the same route. I don't want to get to a place where I feel like I want to die. And maybe if I learn this stuff, I can help other people to also not get to the same place. So I studied applied psychology in Cork, in University College Cork. And it was during that I learned about emotional anhedonia, and that can be a symptom of depression, which is you stop feeling anything, you just go completely numb. And I realized that's what I had at the time. So this was maybe when I was 20.
But I continued to deny I had depression because of like self-stigma. So I thought at this time in my life, I would have viewed like having a mental illness as like a failure, or that I'd let my parents down or I'd let my friends down and people would treat me differently. So I ignored it for a further year until I had this massive panic attack. And it was my first panic attack ever in the street on a night out in Cork. And it just came out of nowhere and it was so horrible. And the next day I was like, right, I can't deny this anymore. I need to get help. I'm not dealing with Irby's death. And like, instead of dealing with it, you know, I was like, I was in college, so I was drinking a lot. There was a lot of casual sex going on. There was infrequent drug use, to be fair. I didn't really turn to drugs, which thank God I didn't, because I was still playing basketball. So that was kind of keeping me on the straight and narrow. But yeah, it just really like Irby's death, like, completely changed the next 4 or 5 years of my life and like shaped my college experience. And like, I basically wasn't feeling anything for 4 or 5 years. And it's interesting now to look back and like, a lot of that time is really hard to remember, because I think you need an emotional reaction to situations to remember them, like to encode the memory. So because I wasn't feeling anything, like nothing really, like nothing spiked. So it's all kind of blurry. Whereas now, thank God, I'm back in an emotional life and I can remember the good and the bad moments in like a lot more detail, which is thank God for that.
So you have this panic attack, you know, you have this kind of, you know, aha moment at that point. Where does that send you as far as starting to find the healing modalities that work for you?
So luckily I was doing a course in psychology. So, and I was with my friends, so they took me home, and then the next day they were like, you should just go to student counseling, the student counseling service. And a lot of them were using it. So there was like no stigma between us about like, you know, going to therapy, which was huge, especially at that time. Like we're talking 2014. So like 11 years ago, like it's a completely different landscape for like encouraging getting help. So that was fine. My friends were like, yeah, here's the links, here's how you sign up, etc. And then the next step for me, and this is probably the biggest step, is like I was really scared to tell my parents, like really, really nervous to tell my parents. Because again, like the stigma and the anxiety, I was like, they're going to think there's something wrong with me. They're going to think I let them down. They're going to be disappointed. So I eventually like worked up enough courage to tell them over dinner one evening, and like the opposite was true. Like they just wanted me to be safe and be happy and to get whatever help I needed just to like get back on track. So like once I had that kind of hurdle jumped and I had them at my back, I was like, right, we just need to like we do this like with basketball training or studying, like we just now need to just go and do this and just like work at it. So then I started going to counseling in college, and I was there for, I think it was like 4 or 5 months, maybe 6 months. And during this time is when I discovered journaling, which, you know, because my therapist was kind of said that like, because you're like not connecting with emotions and you can't identify emotions, writing down everything you're feeling in your body and the thoughts you're feeling will help you to like kind of reignite that system. And the way I talk about it is like emotions for me at this time are kind of like, say if you and one of your friends are like in a pool and you both go underwater and your friend starts shouting at you underwater, like you can see that he's shouting at you, but you can't hear anything he's saying, like it's completely unintelligible. That's kind of how emotions felt. I was like, I know there's something there, but I don't know what it is and it's not very strong. And so writing it down kind of helped to like fan the flame of the emotion, and I was able to like be like, okay, this is sadness. And this is what sadness feels like, and kind of just hold on to it. Cause I was like, it's better to feel sad than to feel nothing. And through that process is kind of how I started writing poetry then, because my journaling style was very just like shorthand, like small bursts of kind of thought. And that's kind of what my poetry style is like. And I remember one of my journal entries I just sent to a poet friend of mine in the UK, and she was like, you could like probably get this published in like a journal or something. And I was like, oh, I wasn't sending it for you for that reason or whatever. But so I did. I sent that to a couple of journals and I got that poem published when I was like 22 or 23. And that's kind of my foray into writing begins then, because I suppose at this time as well, in tandem with that, I'd started the blog, Thoughts Too Big. So I was writing for mental health specifically, and that didn't really feel like creative writing. It kind of felt more like a, I don't know, like a vocation, or I was preaching, or I was trying to help, or whatever I was trying to do, but it didn't feel like creative. And I would have never really thought of myself as creative. I'd put myself in a box as like good at school and decent at basketball. I took myself out of the creative box, even though like now looking back, I'm inherently obviously creative. So the going to therapy, it got me out of depression and introduced me to like potentially like playing around with writing.
It's funny you say that it was the preconceived idea that your parents would have shame about how you were feeling that was the barrier. And so often when we actually do the thing, you know, 90-95% of the time, it's not the outcome that we're thinking of. I did skydiving in New Zealand years ago, and before, like, I was absolutely shitting myself, you know, metaphorically and physically. It was my girlfriend at the time that had got me signed up. Went up in the plane. You know, now you're hanging outside a plane, strapped to a dude. He flings you out. By the time I landed, I was ready to become an instructor. I was just like, this was incredible. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's so crazy how that fear of is crippling. And most of the time, this is, you know, this example especially, let's just stay with men for a moment. Men think, you know, oh, what will people think of me? They'll think I'm weak. But when they actually just reach out and say, I'm struggling, it's the opposite. Most people want to help.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so true. And it's something I say to people now, because a lot of times people are like saying, oh, but like, I don't want to burden someone with the conversation. Like, I don't want to like, ruin someone's day by talking to them about like how I'm feeling. And I'm like, most people will be glad they're the person you came to. Like, they'll get something out of like the fact that you can depend on them. Like, that will be big for them, because it's always big for me. If someone comes to me and tells me something, I'm like, well, thanks for like trusting me with this and for thinking like I'm someone you could tell. So like, it's very rare that like, I don't think I've ever heard of a case, unless it's like an abusive relationship where someone's spoken about their mental health and the other person's been like, will you stop? I actually don't want to hear this. Like, it's never really happened in my experience. And but like, as you said, it was the fear of like of what could happen and my kind of preconceived anxiety of the worst possible outcome that was stopping me from getting help for a long time. Like,
what I've learned as we progress through, because it's funny you said 2014, you know, as far as the, you know, kind of pre this conversation, and it's true, I would say 2016 was about the time we started having this in the first responder community in America, at least. And the ones that were the naysayers, the ones that were out there saying, oh, it's just weakness, it's being a pussy, whatever, I know now are the ones that were probably hurting the most. And so actually, if you do get that kind of response, obviously, firstly, find someone else to lean into, but then secondly, check on that person, because they're still stuck in that old way of thinking.
As I said, like, the number of people who aren't ready is getting smaller, but like, you're still going to have backlash. And I'm sure like in the communities you're in, like, there's probably still people who are like, sure, what is James doing? Like, why is he talking about this? And like, even my own content, like anything I do about mental health, invariably there's someone saying like terrible stuff about it. And like, that's always going to be the case. We're never going to get to 100%, but we can definitely get to a place where a majority of people are like at least open to the possibility of this conversation. Because like, a lot of people in my life still aren't ready to like be totally vulnerable. And like, I would never expect everyone to be like as publicly vulnerable as I've been. But I would like, you know, to know, or to be assured that like, if my friends need to talk, they can talk. That's kind of where we want to get. For everyone, is like, if you need to, like, you don't have to always be talking, but if you need to talk, that you can.
I think framing it, which is completely true, framing vulnerability as courage as well. Like, it's not cowardice that you're struggling, you know. I mean, if you can come out and say, I need help, that's the ultimate courageous act.
Yeah. Like, Andrew Porter is a Irish rugby player. he famously said, like, you can be strong and vulnerable at the same time. They're not like working against each other. And as you said, like, sometimes the most strong thing you can do is to be like, I'm not able to do this on my own. Like, that takes balls.
Absolutely. Well, thinking about your timeline, obviously the pandemic hit around 2020. What, if any, impact did that have on your healing journey?
It was definitely a bit of a backslide. So before that, I came to Dublin briefly to do a master's in linguistics, and I definitely had a backslide in regards to depression then. And it's probably because moved to a new city, was out of rhythm with a routine, didn't know a lot of people, just kind of slid back into like old habits of like, I suppose to pre-context that. So the first time I had depression, I didn't know about it, didn't know I had it. But then I learned about it, and I learned like what habits and like symptoms I was displaying. So when it started to backslide during my master's, which would have been 2017, I could kind of feel it coming in terms of like, I was wanting to sleep more. I didn't want to go basketball training. When I'm experiencing depression, like, I find it very hard to do really simple things like brush my teeth and shower and make my bed and all this kind of stuff, like really difficult. So that happened, and I went back to therapy that time. And then similar things started happening during the pandemic, because like, I've always relied, not exclusively, but like fairly heavily on exercise for my mental health. I think like, I've been a gym goer my whole life, and I was playing basketball still at the time, and I've done marathons and all that. Like, I find it like, not even from like, I don't really care about the aesthetic part of it, but it's very much like, this is good for my mental health. And then the pandemic, like, couldn't go to the gym, basketball season was canceled. And then there was like, you can go 2 kilometers from your house in Ireland at one point. So I was like starting to seep back into those kind of depressive behaviors. So I started like making a list of like everything I could do right now or in the next couple of hours that would improve my mental health. And this became like what I call like a mental health routine. And most of the stuff on it is the exact same things that would be on your physical health routine, but I just look at them from like a mental health perspective. So it's like exercising, getting enough sleep, drinking enough water, spending time with friends, spending time on your own. And they were like the 5 things I was like, right, if I do all these things as often as I can, like, obviously you're not going to spend time with friends every day necessarily, but like 2 or 3 times a week to try and spend time with friends. I was like, if I do all these things, this is going to give me a baseline of well-being. And then I like fill out the rest of the list with stuff I like personally. So for example, like, I'm a massive Marvel nerd, like, love Marvel. So I'm like, right, every time a movie's coming out, buy a ticket so you have something to look forward to. And I think that's important, having something to look forward to on the horizon. And then for me, like, obviously reading is important, writing is important. Some people might hate that, so they wouldn't put that in their mental health routine. But like, whatever, you know, gives you a bit of joy to put on your mental health routine. And that really helped. And it gave me a kind of like a toolkit of like, if I was feeling anxious or low, that I'd be like, right, I can go through my list and see what I haven't been hitting, and maybe I'm only getting 5 hours of sleep a night, or maybe I'm not drinking enough water, or I haven't exercised in 2 days. So it kind of acts as like an alarm system in that sense, where you're like, oh, I've been feeling anxious now all day, what's the problem? And I can, maybe it's something I can actually change that will help this. And then if I'm like feeling anxious a couple of days in a row and I'm doing all my mental health stuff, that then alerts me to be like, maybe I need to seek further help. Maybe I need to check in with my GP or go back to therapy for a couple of sessions or whatever it is. So it really like was a really simple tool that I developed out of kind of necessity that I've been using ever since. And it kept me out of depression in the pandemic, which was massive.
That's, I mean, firstly, it's amazing to hear. Did you ever watch the Marvel film Thunderbolts?
Yeah.
I mean, that, we're talking about mental health. That was a phenomenal film to really kind of shine some light on exactly what we've been talking about, strength and vulnerability.
100%. Like, I was like, I remember I came out of that and I was like, I love that the final battle scene was a group hug. Like, that was like,
exactly.
You know, like that it was great. Yeah, it was great. And like risky as well for like, even in like Hollywood to be like, we're not going to do the typical superhero thing. We're going to like talk about a real mental health issue and address it from this angle, like, so props to them.
Absolutely. But I think also, like, you know, hearing you talking about that, obviously you'd had the ability to really create a plan. I think there's some great things. Sleep deprivation is something I talk about all the time, for example. So that alone can massively impact your mental health. But retroactively looking at what was done well during COVID and what was done poorly, you know, and there's a massive mental health ripple effect from the isolation, the shutdowns, the loss of autonomy that I think we need to learn from. We need to reflect and say, okay, next time, because it will happen again, there'll be another virus. It's going to be predatory. What can we do differently so we protect the vulnerable, but we don't, you know, have this long-term effect on everyone else that was kind of, you know, kept from their passions of sports and nature and community and relationships, you know, and that way, you know, minimize the long-term effect of this.
Yeah, because I think, you know, you hear a lot in like the news and stuff about like the COVID kids or the COVID generation and how like as a result of, you know, babies who were born in the pandemic and spent the first 2-3 years of their life never seeing another kid, that they don't know how to socialize and they lost a lot of like development, really important developmental like skills that are, they just can't get back now because of the lockdown. And then, yeah, like, I've always been a bit suspicious of like, they released the suicide statistics for 2020 and 2021 in Ireland, and those years for some reason just dropped dramatically in the statistics. And I'm like, I feel like that's not true. You know, I feel like you're kind of like fudging the data so you don't have to take accountability for the fact that like a massive lockdown caused people to have serious mental health problems and that resulted in death. Like, obviously they don't want to take responsibility for that. And maybe that's a bit conspiratorial, but like, it feels unlikely that it would have dropped. Like, it would have been more believable if they said like, oh, it's the same as last year or like slightly more than last year. But it dropping in those years is kind of hard to believe.
Well, I mean, there was a running joke that, you know, you could be killed in a car crash and your death certificate would say COVID. And this was happening, you know, a lot. Yeah. It's being attacked to everything. And then conversely.
Yeah, like, so yeah. So say like, so some, like, awfully, like some poor young fella took his own life, but he happened to be positive for COVID. They would have said that was a COVID death. Like,
yeah, exactly. And then the other way, then shortly after that, people were saying, yeah, if anyone died, oh, it was the vaccine. So either way, two extremes. It's like, no, this person was shot with an arrow or whatever it was. It was neither of those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, there were definitely some skewing.
I don't think it was COVID.
All right. Well, then you alluded as well to, you know, counseling, your GP. So we're going to get to the writing in a moment. I already want to dive into the poetry and the books. But before we do, what are other tools in your toolbox? You talked about hydration and sleep and Marvel films. What are other things that have helped you navigate your way out of this?
Well, I think like it would be remiss and just very dishonest if I didn't talk about writing in this context as well. Like, we don't have to get into the weeds of the actual what I've produced, but like, genuinely, like, there is something, and this is why I'm so drawn to it and why I write so much. Like, there is something I get from just the act of writing that gives me a lot. Like, I might find it hard to spend time on my own, but if I'm spending time on my own and I'm writing and creating, you know, it changes from loneliness to solitude in that sense. Like, it does give me a massive amount. So that's like another big tool that's been useful for me. And again, like, you know, you watched the TED Talk, like, so I've talked a lot about how creativity is really important for mental health. And like, writing isn't going to be everyone's bag. Like, some people hate writing. Like, I totally understand why. A lot of people have trauma from school for writing. But like, having a creative practice, I think, whatever it may be, and like, I think is massive. And I think for whatever reason, and it's probably linked to like the concepts of masculinity and femininity, like, I feel like men resist a creative practice for the sake of itself. Like, if it's not producing something or gaining them something, they're like, what's the point in having a creative practice? But like, the times I've just sat down and like, because I'm really bad at drawing and painting, but like, the times I've sat down and just drawn or painted, I've gotten a lot of like relaxation and like comfort from it. And it's just a bit of fun. Like, and then you have something that you've produced at the end. And like, I hang some of my paintings up and they're truly terrible, but I'm like, I painted that. So, like, you know, there's something there, and I think it just gives you a lot, and it gives you a place to express emotions, and especially, again, talking about men, when we're, you know, traditionally bad at expressing our emotions verbally, having a creative process to put your emotions into and express how you're feeling is huge, because then you can, in theory, like, put the conversation on the long finger and express it through your art. And, like, I constantly do that with my poetry and with my writing. And sometimes, like, I won't even know I'm feeling a certain way until I write about it. And I'm like, oh, I've been, like, really stressed about that, and I didn't even really consciously know until I started writing about it. So that's a tool, like, creativity. And then I spoke about, you know, learning to spend time with yourself. And I read this really good book. It's called Solitude by a guy named Michael Harris. And he talks about the benefits of solitude, and how we've lost the kind of skill for solitude in modern life, because, like, you know, the example he uses, like, if you're sitting at home on your own and there's no TV on and there's no podcast and you're just sitting, he's like, what's the first thing you do? It's like, within the first 30 seconds, you whip out your phone and you start scrolling. Like, we're kind of, we've conditioned ourselves to, like, be afraid of boredom. And he talks about, like, all the massive brain benefits of, like, allowing your brain to go idle. And he cites, like, how all these great minds, like your Yeats and your Oscar Wilde and your Einsteins, like, quote, these big long walks they used to take. And obviously they didn't have podcasts back then or anything, so they'd just be going for walks on their own. And that's when they got their ideas, because your brain starts wandering and it starts connecting things. And then that's when they have their moments of, like, that's how I finished that story, or that's how I finished that equation, or that's how I finished that piece of work. It's like, you do need to find a way to spend time with yourself. And I think if you can, anything that happens, you can deal with, because you're comfortable on your own. And this is coming from someone who, like, when I was depressed, the very last thing I wanted to do was spend time on my own. I avoided it at all costs, because that's when things were the worst. So I, you know, have had to teach myself how to be on my own. And it's like, I kind of compared to, like, a meditative practice. Like, if you've never meditated, you don't just sit down and meditate for an hour first time. You do, like, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You build it up. So it's the same with, like, learning to be on your own. It's like, all right, I'm going to sit here for 5 minutes and with nothing and see what happens. And that's how you learn to, like, I think, and yeah, spend time on your own. Because I think, like, looking back, if I had that skill during the pandemic, when we were all on our own, if I was, like, able to, like, spend time with myself, it would have been a lot easier. It still wouldn't have been great, but it would have been more manageable, because it'd be like, all right, I know how to spend time with myself. And I think that is a really important point. Like, it is a relationship with yourself. It's not like you're just on your own. Like, it is, like, how you talk to yourself, how you think, like, the conversation between you and you is a real thing. And it's how you get to know yourself and what you want and what you don't want and what you like and where you want to go. And, like, getting to know someone else, if you want to get to know yourself, you have to spend the time. So I do think of it like that, like, not in a kind of crazy way where I think there's two versions of me, but, like, very much like, to get to know myself, I need to spend the time to get to know myself. So therefore, sit down here and do nothing.
I can relate for several reasons. Firstly, when I take my dog for a walk, and that's usually twice a day for, you know, like 30 minutes, 40 minutes, I always leave my phone behind. So that way it's not a distraction. I don't listen to music, don't listen to podcasts, anything. I just walk my dog. And it's amazing how that's when, as you said, things will start popping up. And I've written two books now. The last one was kind of a fiction, pseudo, almost historical fiction. And these ideas just come out of nowhere. And it's crazy, but you cannot have the capacity for, you know, not even original thought, but these unique thoughts, if you like, if you've got this busy mind. And I use NewCalm, which is like a down regulation app that you can use. I use Headspace to do meditation, and not diligently every single day, but understanding when my mind is getting busy, that monkey mind. And it's incredible when you force yourself to be present, the incredible thoughts and concepts that start presenting themselves. But when you're, like you said, immediately from the car to the TV, to the app, to the podcast, to the whatever, you literally haven't given your brain the ability to take a breath and go, have you thought about this?
Yeah, no, 100, like, spot on. That's like a perfect example of like the concept Michael Harris is talking about. And like, it is always the case, because like, you can even like, there's proof of concept in like your own life as well. Like, because I never get the idea for like the poem or the book when I'm sitting ready to write. It's like when I'm out chatting to a friend over coffee, or I'm in the shower, or I'm on the walk. It's like when I'm actually like present in what I'm doing, that's when the things go like, look at this, as opposed to being like just distracting myself the whole time. So like, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, talk to me then about the catharsis. So, you know, when I wrote these books, you said about people hate, right? And I had a kind of love-hate relationship. When I got into that flow and things would vomit out of my head, it was amazing. But there were other times where I'm looking at the blinking cursor and it's, you know, it's frustrating. It's the opposite. But, you know, getting this out of my mind and onto the page, I did feel this kind of, you know, weight off the shoulders element. So Talk to me about the kind of the journey that you've had with poetry and how that's been, you know, related to the upswing of your own mental health.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, because even to this, well, not to this day, that would be untrue, but like, for most of my writing career, poetry has been the kind of, to equate it to like doodling on the side of the page when you don't want to do your work. Like that's how poetry started. Like, so I'd be writing, because I started, like, my first book was a collection of short stories, and so was the second one. And then I did a collection of essays on mental health called Lonely Boy, which I imagine kind of had the similar characteristics as you, where it's like I was getting all this stuff out of me. It was like doing self-therapy. It was absolutely amazing to write. And then, like, when I was getting to that place where I couldn't, like, get in the flow, that's where I'd be like, right, let's try a poem. It was kind of like the step away and do the poem. And now, obviously, like, in the last couple of years, I've become, the thing I'm known most for is my poetry. And I feel like it was kind of the mistress in my writing career for so long. Like, I was kind of, like, doing it on the side. So for a long time, I wasn't taking it massively seriously. And I think maybe that is part of the reason there's been success, because I wasn't like overcooking it or overthinking it. I was just like, here's a thought, I'll make a poem out of it. And then I was like really trying hard with the essays and short stories, and they were almost harder to get out as a result. So it's always been just like a fun thing I've done, in particular the poetry, like just a kind of fun thing. Like let's explore this idea in a like short and creative way to try and like, and always trying to make it like relatable, to the sense of like, it would be great for people to know they're not, how they're feeling isn't like unique to them, that like this is a universal human experience. Someone else is feeling it, you're not alone in this. And that's how I've always come at poetry and all my writing to a degree. And there is just a lot of like, you know, this feeling of like accomplishment when you like finish a piece and you really feel like you've kind of grasped the entire concept in like 15 lines of poetry, or like that's how it feels. Like that's a snapshot of how that feels, or how that conversation went, or how that experience was. Like there it is. And there's like a real feeling of like, we did something today. Like we got something done today, and it's that. And I think that is probably the feeling I'm always chasing, is like, how can I, like, I want to express this universal human experience in the best way possible, so that when someone else reads it, they'll be like, because this is the one compliment I get, that I have, this is my favorite thing ever, when people say, I've always felt like that, I just never knew how to put it into words. That is the best. Like there's nothing that beats that. And that's kind of what I get out of it. Like if someone says that to me, I'm like, right, we did good.
Is there a correlation between the poems that hit you the hardest that you write and the popularity or the impact that they have on other people?
There's almost a negative correlation, to be honest. So it's always the ones, it's like, for example, like if I ever have boys, right, that day, well, prior to that, I'd posted that poem before, not that exact same video, but like me just to my phone. And it did fine. It got like maybe like 15,000 views. It was good, fine. And then that day that I posted that specific video, it was very much a case of like, right, I had that, like that whole set that I did, you know, chopped up and ready to go. And I had nothing like ready to post for that day. So I was like, I'll just put this one up. I'll just throw this up. And then it like overnight, I woke up the next day and I was like, what the hell is going on? So like, I didn't expect that to do what it did. And that always kind of seems to be the case, because there's another poem I have called Tobronarum, which in Irish means I am sad. And it's just an exploration of, you know, how the Irish language kind of addresses language, because like the direct or addresses emotion, because the direct translation for Tobronarum is sadness is upon me. So it's how like sadness isn't like connected to you, or you're not actually sadness, it's just on you. And it's a really lovely way to address emotions. But again, I thought that poem was just like middle of the road. I haven't really connected with it that much. And then that poem also goes up. So like, yeah, it's almost like the ones I really love, people are like, whatever. And the ones I'm kind of like, I don't know, people love. So it's hard to navigate.
So if you are able to, I would love to firstly hear you read If I Ever Have Boys, and I want to just talk about that, because I think, you know, I mean, the popularity I really believe is because there is a yearning now to make the world better, to make the world kinder. And, you know, the parents of the world, we have the, you know, we're at the wheel of this. You know, you can either create kind, strong, compassionate children, or we can pour this kind of divisiveness that we've been exposed to into our kids and then create more issues. So, and then we'll contrast that with one of your specific, you know, favorite poems, if you'd like. But I'd love if that's okay to get you to read If I Ever Have Boys.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, this is the If I Ever Have Boys, which is in response to Dangerous Men by Lucas Jones. If I ever have boys, they'll be dangerous men. They'll smile at dogs and children and be a tonic to friends. They'll send flowers to their mother just because, and they'll be a shoulder for many when the world is too much. My boys will know that vulnerability is strength. They won't bottle anger, they'll learn how to express. They won't let pride be the reason they hide wearing masks while they're hurting inside. My boys will be dangerous men. They won't stay silent even when it's uncomfortable for them. They learn that their actions are more effective than words, but they'll use their voices to amplify the unheard. They'll know that love isn't something to perform. They'll see beauty in all of its forms. My boys won't grow learning to emotionally hide. They'll reshape masculinity into something they like, make it softer to touch. They'll know that who they are is more than enough. They'll know that being a man doesn't mean carrying the burden alone. They learn that an emotional man is a man fully grown. They won't settle everything with violent swings. They live in truth even when that truth stings. So yeah, if I ever have boys, they'll be dangerous men. But the danger they'll be won't be the one society meant. You know?
I absolutely love it. I mean, I my whole parenting ethos has been kindness. So I'll give you a quick backstory. When my son was, you know, tiny, like a little toddler, I'd give him a little pat on the thigh, you know, if he did something he wasn't supposed to be doing, like a gentle pat on the thigh. And then as he got a little bit older, the timeout thing was big here in America. And so the whole purpose is you put him in a corner, you say, you can't come out. And it's for every year that they are old, it's supposed to be a minute in timeout. And then you tell them, okay, this is why you were in timeout. You know, do you understand what you did? And then you say you can leave now. Well, my son called my bluff and said, I don't want to leave. And I was like, well, fuck, that doesn't work anymore then, does it? So but it was, he was at an age where he was finally really understand me. And so I shifted to, is what you are doing kind? That's it. And that was the principle. And he's 18 years old now. And at the same time, putting him in jiu-jitsu, you know, and soccer and CrossFit and all these things where he was becoming a strong, you know, arguably pseudo dangerous child into an adult. And so using that strength when it's needed to protect the vulnerable, to speak for the vulnerable, I think is a beautiful message. It's what we need, because I grew up, my generation was the Stallone, Schwarzenegger, you know, bodybuilder, take everyone out round the back and beat them up. That'll teach them a lesson. Put the nose in the brain. All this bullshit that we were taught. And it's rubbish. Yeah. It's rubbish because the World War II generation weren't talking like that. You know what I mean? So this is what really resonated with me with that poem, is I felt like it was the exact message that our young boys and our parents need to hear in 2025.
No, I appreciate that. And I think, yeah, that question is so simple, but so effective. Like, is what you're doing kind? Because that's, if you ask that question, you get to the root of the problem pretty quickly in every situation. But with the poem, like, because obviously, like, there's some people who are like, oh, this is like whatever, like castrating men or whatever. It's like reducing men to something that isn't masculine. And I'm like, no, the point is that, like, obviously men have like an increased like physical ability, and we have the potential to hurt basically anyone around us. And it's to use that, like, you know, it's the Spider-Man thing, with great power comes great responsibility, to use that, like, that advantage for like good, and to be compassionate and kind, and to, you know, if it's in a crowd of, say, like a crowd and there's mostly men, like, it's probably going to be very dangerous and scary for a woman to stand up and speak out, but like to use your voice as a man to be like, this isn't okay, we can't be doing this, like, and to be that man is what it's about. It's not about like reducing men down, it's to use what we have for like the greater good, which I think is like inherently obvious for like good men. Like, good men know that. It's kind of for, so it's mainly like a reminder to good men, and then like a call out to bad men to be like, we need to do better.
I've had a real awakening the last year or so, where I realize a lot of people that are behind very heinous acts are simply themselves suffering from mental ill health. Again, you know, means that compassionately, empathetically, that they, if you went back to, you know, whether it's the troubles in Northern Ireland, whether it's what's going on in Gaza, whether it was the people that were behind the decisions for the potato famine, you know, 100 plus years ago, whatever it was, that these people could sleep soundly doing such horrific things, whether it's with money, with weapons, with their fists. You know, that is a mental health crisis. And I think this, you know, the poem is really showing the ultimate courage is working on yourself. Like, if you heal yourself, then you're able to then be a good parent and then start molding your child to be kind and compassionate and strong. And then you walk out into your community and you're kind and compassionate and strong. But with, and I just did a video on this yesterday, with this kind of rhetoric that's banging around at the moment, with this kind of anti-immigration, you know, feeling, air quotes, I just see a lot of hurt men, you know, hurt people hurt people. And, you know, yes, there are areas where some, you know, immigration policies need to be overwatched so that we're not just opening floodgates for certain groups. I totally understand that. But a lot of horrendous things in our history happened when we painted the boogeyman and we said that group of people are the bad guys. And so I think, again, circling around to kindness and compassion, you know, if you're the head of a, you know, a drug company that produces OxyContin that creates an opioid crisis, you know, or, you know, a chemical company that then is poisoning the planet with forever chemicals, and, you know, you're sleeping at night, that's the same person, the same kind of person. So putting that kindness and compassion lens, even on the arguably sociopaths of the world, is still the same conversation. Is it kind or is it unkind? And the more we can heal ourselves in the middle, the more we can then start pushing the boundaries left and right. And then, in, you know, kind of enclosing more and more people in their healing journey as well.
Yeah. I mean, no notes, man. You absolutely nailed that. I think, yeah, like, genuinely, like, it's so true that if you can be someone who's, you know, heading up a genocide, or even being on the side of a genocide, or, yeah, like, just allowing horrible things to happen to your brothers and sisters, because we're all humans, so we're all in this together, like, we're all alone in this together. If you're happy to let that go on and you can sleep soundly at night, then, yeah, there is something off. Like, and I think that's a planet-wide sickness, you know, that's a, yeah, just global mental health, which is, I don't, it's such a big problem to solve, but I think we don't have to solve it all at once. It's all incremental stuff. It's all a poem here, a conversation here, get people talking. Like, that's how we change the tide, because there's no way to just, like, unfortunately, like, just wave a magic wand and be like, stop that. That's not good.
Yeah. And I would say you want to change the world, start at home. So the only ability everyone listening has that you have, that I have, is to look in the mirror and go, well, what do I need to do? To myself first, you know, my own self work. And then who else are, you know, am I sharing this home with? How can I positively affect them? If 100 million people did that, imagine the change. So, and this is the thing with your poetry, with the book that I'm turning into a show. I mean, the reach of some of these things now, you know, potentially, as you said, you know, that one poem went viral. So we do have the ability to put these positive messages out and then walk the walk, not just be standing on some ivory tower. That I think that there is really a desire for a renaissance of kindness, compassion, and community. I really do. And I'm just so incurably optimistic about that. You know, I refuse to believe that people aren't inherently good. So we just got to refine that part of us.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you kind of have to live with that belief in your heart to make it through the day at the moment that, like, good will prevail, like, and that there are still good people. It's just we're in a dark place in the world right now. We've been here for a while, but that doesn't mean we can't come out of it. It's just going to take some graft and some patience, I think.
Absolutely. Well, that was one of the poems that you said really took off when it was put on social media. What about one of your favorite ones, if you want to read one of those?
One of my favorite ones. Okay, this one's short, but I really like this one. And it kind of, honestly, this wasn't even planned, but this kind of touches on a lot of what we've already been talking about. So this is called Those Who Hold. You can tell a lot about a person by how they handle pain. Some people are afraid to touch it, to have it. They hold it like a childless adult holds a baby, uncomfortable wanting to give it to anyone else. And sometimes they do, projecting pain like movies onto whoever comes near. But there are others who accept pain, draw it in close and hold it tight like an old friend, nurse it back to health. And these people are the entire sky. They have capacity for not just their own, but the pain of others too. The same way the sky can hold an infinity of clouds and not shatter. These people are miracles, taking suffering from those who can't hold it any longer.
Beautiful.
That one. Thank you.
When I hear people talking about navigating their own crucible when they were in the darkest of places, and again, not to suggest for a moment that everyone that comes out the other side is perfectly healed and never has a struggle again, but, you know, come through that kind of healing journey, as it were, over and over again, people seem to come out the woodwork and say, I'm struggling too. How did you do that? And that in itself, the ability to then be able to help further bolsters their own healing journey. What have you seen as far as that with your poetry and writing?
I mean, over the years, like, I've been doing this work for almost 11 years now. I started when I was like 20 with the mental health stuff and then the poetry, whatever else. And there's always, like, always messages of people, like, they just want to get something off their chest and they just want to talk. And sometimes people just come out with it and that's the first message. And some people ask, and I think, you know, both are fine. But I think the things that, like, there are certain moments where, like, the universe kind of tells you you're on the right path. I remember last September, and this again is like an example of a poem that I was just like, I just need to put something up today because of the day it is. So it was World Suicide Prevention Day. And obviously I do a lot of work specifically about suicide because of what happened. So I put up a poem. I was on the road somewhere and I wrote a poem in my hotel room and I recorded it in that hotel room. And then I put it up and I was like, okay, that's us covered for Suicide Prevention Day. I probably haven't done enough this year, but I was just busy. And then 2 days later, I got a message on TikTok off a woman. And in short, she was like, I was about to take my own life. I listened to your poem and then I listened to it again and I listened to it again and I'm still here. and she just wanted to say thanks, and that she was gonna, she was still struggling, but she was gonna try and find help, and that the poem really helped. And I was like, just blown away by that, like that, you know, whatever about like things can go viral, you can have loads of followers and stuff, but like to be able to like know for sure that like something I've written has saved someone's life is really like, it makes me uncomfortable, but it's massive, like it's a huge honor, and I don't take it lightly, because like, you know, it gets to a point where you are affecting people's lives, and you can either do it negatively or positively. And I think that for me is a sign that, like, you know, I chose the right path, because there was a time where it could have gotten very dark, and I could have become a different man, and I was becoming a different man, and I got the help I needed, and I started writing as a result of that. And I remember when that happened with that message, one of my closest friends text me, and he was like, you've done all this work for the last 10 years to save that woman's life. That's what it was all for. And I was like, that is an insane thing to try and think about. But yeah, I think that's the best example I have of like my own healing helping someone else, and their journey with that helping me. I think that was huge.
I mean, I say this a lot, you know, I've done over 1,100 conversations now, and it's the same thing. Like, it's all free that I put out there. And if it helps one single person, then it was worth mm-hmm. it. Obviously, your poetry, this podcast, my books, your books, you know, even though we may not know it, we know that they're going to make even more of an impact than that. But it doesn't matter. One human life is still worth all of this effort. And when you were talking about that story, as I progressed through these, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of conversations, one of the things that really became apparent was, as someone experiences that kind of perfect storm of all the contributing factors that lead someone towards suicide ideation, the brain becomes truly miswired. You know, whether it's unaddressed sleep unaddressed childhood trauma, sleep deprivation, organizational betrayal, side effects of, you know, psych meds and alcohol and all the things. And at that point, there's a shift where, you know, of course, there's one part where someone just wants the suffering to end, this crippling depression, mm-hmm. the pain, etc. But then there's another part that people don't normally talk about, which is there's a voice that starts convincing someone that they are the reason for their loved one's pain. And if they just remove themselves, everyone will be happier. And that's a complete fallacy, that we can see that with a healthy mind from the outside looking in. But in that moment, which is, you know, reframe suicide a lot of times, because if that's what someone really believes, at that moment, in that distorted frame of mind, that suicide is actually very selfless and courageous, not cowardly and selfish. But to pull that person back from that metaphorical ledge, to give their mind a moment to just realize, whoa, what the hell was going on? What, you know, what were we trying to convince you that was wrong? Might be a song, might be a poem, might be a phone call. And so this is where I think these are so important, because I've had people, Emma, Kevin Hines, who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. The moment that trigger is squeezed, the moment that they let go of that railing, immediately they snap back to reality, but it's too late. So if a phone call, if a dog walking in, if, you know, whatever it is, like I said, a poem can pull someone from that psychosis for a second. And I mean that, use that term deliberately, because it's a distorted way of thinking at that moment, then it really is saving a life. It really is. So this is why all these mediums, you know, are important, whether it's, you know, like I said, written word, whether it's, you know, someone might just look at a picture and have this thought. They might just look out the window and see, you know, something beautiful outside. But if the world is devoid of all these positive influences, there aren't going to be those moments that are going to be just enough to pull that person back from the brink.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It reminds me of, have you ever seen that Ethan Hawke video where he's like, no one gives us a shit about poetry until they need it. It's like, and someone dies and there's, well, yeah. And it is very much, it's a really important point to make, because, you know, you do have that old kind of tired trope of people saying that like suicide is selfish, but like the people who are in that place, truly think they're doing everyone a favor. Like, they think they're the problem. So I think it's really important to say that as much as we can, that like, they're not doing this out of like selfishness at all. It's very much the thinking you were describing. And yes, and to provide in any capacity, whether, as you said, it's a podcast or a poem, that kind of circuit breaker to give them a little break to be like, what the fuck am I doing? Yeah, I mean, in that sense, throw as much shit as the wall as you can and see what sticks. Like, whatever works. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't even necessarily have to be that deep. It can just be something. It could be a joke.
Absolutely. Well, we've talked about your journey, you know, as far as short stories and then poetry. What are you projecting as next? The more of the same as far as, you know, staying within this medium, or are you starting to even expand in other areas?
So, yeah, so I've done the poetry, the essays, the short fiction. I've written the first draft of a novel, and that kind of, it's like a fictionalization of like the events of my 17-year-old year when my best friend died and the kind of aftermath of that. It's kind of a fictionalization of that. So would like to get that published soon. There'll always be more poetry. There'll never not be poetry. I think the thing I'm most excited about at the moment is I recently started collaborating with a British artist named Throwing Snow, who's a producer, and he makes like electronic music, and we're making a kind of spoken word electronic album. So we released our first song in June, and that went really well. We've got a lot of like radio time and all that stuff you want to see. And since then, we've recorded like, I want to say like 18 songs, spoken word and electronic. And it's been so much fun because, like, you know, the thing I would call my career is the writing the books. So doing music is kind of just like a bonus round, and it's all fun and it's all new and I have no expectations for it. So there's no like stress involved. It's just been a really fun outlet to collaborate with another artist. And obviously I'm biased, but I think we're making something quite exciting and I'm excited to see where it goes. So that's kind of the main next thing. And yeah, to get the next book, get the novel published is the next step for that. And then, like, honestly, like, I've never planned a day in my life. Everything that's happened to me so far has come from writing, and I've gotten a lot of amazing opportunities over the years. So I'll just continue to lean on that. The writing works. I'll keep writing. I love writing, and every opportunity that comes, we'll take.
I listened to Alan Watt's kind of Spotify, you know, playlist, and a lot of those are exactly like you're talking about, spoken word, but with the kind of ambient music of the background. And it just adds another layer to it when you put music together with poetry.
Yeah, no, it does. And that's why poetry works so well on social media, because like I've done this a lot where like I'll hand the written version of a poem to a friend and they'll be like, oh yeah, cool. And then I'll show them a video of me performing it with music and it will actually connect. And they'll be like, holy fuck, you know, it'll be a completely like more like intense reaction. So I think the music poetry connection is, yeah, it's huge.
So where can people listening find the books, the poetry, and anything else that you're putting out at the moment?
So everything is available online. The books are available in bookshops in Ireland and the UK, and probably obscure ones in some random US state somewhere. But they're all available online. So my website's thoughtstoobig.ie. I'm at Dara Fleming everywhere. And to be extremely lazy, if you would like to find a book, I really appreciate it. And the easiest way to do that is probably just Google Dara Fleming and they pop up.
Absolutely. Yeah. You got a unique name. You pop up straight away.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to throw some quick closing questions at you before I let you go, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right. We talked about your work. Is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend written by other people? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
First one that always comes to mind is anything by Max Porter. His last book was called Shy. Grief is a Thing with Fetters by Max Porter is good. Anything he's written, absolutely amazing. He writes like novels in poetic verse, absolutely class. My favorite poetry chapbook is called Notes in an Emergency by Frank O'Hara. It's about New York in like the 60s and 70s, absolutely brilliant. And then like I wouldn't be a true Irishman if I didn't recommend half of the Irish writers. So Patrick Holloway, Lucy Holmes, Kevin Barry, Wendy Erickson. We, at the moment, I think it's, to be fair, it's always been true, but at the moment we have like such a level of talent in terms of like writing, whether it's poetry or novels or TV or movies coming out of Ireland. So like, yeah, just check it, literally anyone, and you'll be satisfied.
Have you ever crossed paths with a poet called Jer Devine?
No.
Oh, so he is a Dublin firefighter and also a poet.
Jer Devine, hold on. I have.
Yeah, he was on the show two St. Patrick's Days ago. We had a Guinness and did an interview.
He did a gig there the other day in Art Bubble, it's called, and it just popped up on my Instagram the other day. Yeah, I've done a gig with him and everything. So yeah,
there we go. Good. Brilliant. Yeah, an amazing guy. All right. Well, the next question, what about films and documentaries that you love?
Films and documentaries. Like, my favorite movie ever is Good Will Hunting. Just a classic. Robin Williams at his absolute best. I have to just, not even, no, probably contractually at this point, Spider-Man. Gotta do Spider-Man. I'm a massive Spider-Man fan. Like, just complete perfection, any of them. No, I don't really watch a lot of documentaries. What I've been watching recently? I love Slow Horses, if you haven't seen it on Apple TV.
That was brilliant. Like,
yeah, so good. But yeah, I don't watch a massive amount of TV, but when I do, it tends to be like trash. Like, it's The Office or it's Parks and Rec or something, you know. But my favorite movie, Good Will Hunting, There Will Be Blood, another great one. There's a movie called Two Popes, which is about like when Pope Francis took over from Pope Benedict and their kind of relationship. And it's actually, and I'm not like religious or anything, but it's actually class. It's such a like interesting like insight into how like, you know, the way we view these pious people are actually just human beings who have their own agendas, and it's all kind of manipulative as well. But yeah, they're my recs. Not the best.
There was that show, and I'm forgetting what it was called now, but Ricky Gervais did it on grief and death. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, Afterlife.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, really good. Really good.
All right. Well, speaking of great people, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Ooh, another good question. Lots of people coming to mind. I could obviously recommend a lot of poets, but who would I think would be really good? There is a poet named Emmett O'Brien from Dublin. He's like a working class poet from the north of Dublin, and he's absolutely incredible. He's an incredible performer and has a really interesting story. He works, he teaches poetry in prisons in Dublin. Yeah, just a great, and just a great hang, great crack. You'd get good conversation out of them.
That's another whole area when we're talking about kindness and compassion. I had the superintendent of Bastøy prison in Norway on a couple of times now, Tom Eberhardt. And when you look at that model, you know, all the proactive you know, elements where, again, you're talking about looking at the popes as humans, well, prisoners are humans, you know, people that, again, started off as giggling little babies, and then their life took them to an area where maybe it wasn't, you know, full of kindness and compassion, and mistakes were made. But the recidivism rate in Norway is incredibly low. It's because they invest in their incarcerated men and women, because they will move back next door to you one day. You know, I think 95% of prisoners will. So when you hear about these proactive programs in prisons around the world, it's always intriguing.
For sure.
All right. Well, then the last question, before we make sure everyone knows where to find you on all the platforms, just we'll underline that again. What do you do to decompress?
Well, I exercise a lot. Like, I'm always in the gym or going for runs. I mean, watching trash TV, as I said, I am a fiend for trash TV. Like, I do love it. Reading, like, it's partly part of my job, but I also just read to relax as well. And then read, like, on it's the simple stuff, and it's kind of what we talked about earlier. Like, hanging out with people I like really helps me to unwind. Like, actually having good conversations in real life with good people is, if I'm ever having a day where I'm feeling like wound up or stressed or anxious, if I just hang out with a good friend, like, usually sorts itself. It's really important. And because we live in this world where we're all in our own bubbles, isolated but connected to thousands of people, but maybe spending all of our time on our own, I think having a couple of good friends to hang out with is a cure for that.
And do you play basketball now?
I don't, but I do miss it. I stopped playing in 2020, and then I moved to Barcelona in 2023. So I hadn't played for 3 years, but I started playing pickup basketball again in Barcelona, just like, you know, casual enough. And that kind of gave me the bug for it again. So I might, Dublin's a great basketball town, so I might find a team and lock in again.
And what was it took you to Spain?
Kind of like a lot of things, just because I could, one. But like mainly like I was looking for a place to rent in Cork and I couldn't find one. So, and I had a lot of friends living in Barcelona. So I was like, I'll just move there. It'll be cheaper. There's definitely places to rent and I can live in the sun for a couple of years. And it was a great time, but it kind of felt like I was just taking a break from my real life. You know, it was like a 2 year holiday kind of thing. So I was like, I should probably get back to it.
All right. So just one more time for people listening, where are the best places, social media, and what's the name of the website?
So the best social media, Instagram, TikTok, at Dara Fleming. That's probably where I'm most active. And then my website, toss2big.ie. It's primarily just once a week I do a mental health blog, kind of go through what I was dealing with during the week, just to kind of normalize that conversation. There are the three spots.
Brilliant. Well, Dara, I want to thank you so much. Firstly, like I said, just for putting your poetry out. Obviously, it hit, you know, a lot of people. That's how we were connected in the first place. And secondly, for being, you know, courageous, having that vulnerability and telling your story. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.